Through most of the 70s and into the 80s, actor Alan Alda helped make the hit series MASH and the character of Captain Benjamin Franklin Hawkeye Pierce one of the best loved in television. During that time, he not only won a Best Actor Emmy, but received 25 Emmy nominations and became the only person to win the award for writing, acting, and directing episodes of the same series. The iconic role also established the actor as the quintessential nice guy. So it may come as a surprise to some that the 69-year-old actor has received an Oscar nomination for his role as the slick, power-hungry Senator Ralph Owen Brewster in the film The Aviator. This is not his first role as a villain. He's done many films since the end of MASH, including a very memorable bad guy in Woody Allen's Crimes and Misdemeanors. But often it's difficult for an actor to break out of a defining role like the popular Hawkeye. An Academy Award nomination with a new role as the Republican presidential candidate in the new season of West Wing may change all that. A discussion with actor Alan Alda is the talk today. What's your most memorable Alan Alda scene or role? If you have a question for the actor about his latest roles or his career, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Alan Alda joins us from our New York bureau. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Hello, Joe. Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Well, you know, I have to say, first off, that, you know, I have a favorite role that you had, but it's probably a little bit unusual. I'm probably one of the few people that would even bring this up, but I feel I must.
I can't wait to hear what it is.
So in 1963, from July 22nd to August 3rd, you were in a play which was also starring Mary McCarty and Eileen Brennan. At the Bucks County Playhouse, called Annette and Two Guitars.
Oh my goodness! Yeah. And now, how do you know about that?
Well, I know about that because the author was a guy named Alfred Palka.
Oh.
And
that's
Alfred
how I met your
Palka
father.
Is my father? Yes, that's true. It was a long time ago, and I remember, you know, being taken out to Bucks County, very exciting. And then some years later, I remember, and it sticks in my mind. And then we'll stop memory row here. But you were playing in the Apple Tree, which was that play, that great play on Broadway with Barbara Harris, and you went out to lunch with me and my dad at Munganaro's on 9th Avenue. So.
What did we eat?
Okay, you win. I'm done. I give up.
You know, because I remember every dish of pasta I've ever eaten.
Probably
and
so.
I'm surprised they don't remember that lunch. So maybe I had something.
I think it was a mozzarella. What do they always put mozzarella on veal, I think, was what they had there.
Now, well, seriously, this is the talk of the nation?
All right. So, no, the talk of the nation is your Oscar nomination, and I want to. That's where we're going to start. Congratulations.
Whatever you want. Thank you very much. But we can talk about anything you want.
All right. Well, but how does this feel? I mean, you've won so many prizes. I was looking at page after page after page in your biography of these amazing things you've accomplished, and here's another one. Is this one the topper, or is it just yet another?
No, it is. It is. First of all, if you'll notice, there's room at the bottom for more.
But they never put the bottom on the page.
I can make the print smaller. Don't worry about that.
Okay.
It surprises me, as a matter of fact, how much this means to me. First of all, I didn't ever expect this to happen, that I would be nominated for this award, and if I thought if it should ever happen, I couldn't imagine that it would mean this much, and that it would mean so much to people who come up to me on the street. This is a really big deal in everybody's mind. I mean, I think more so than everybody realizes. If they could be with me as people come up and talk to me about it, they're very, very warm with me, and it's like they're cheering me on, it gives them a chance to make more personal contact with somebody who they don't know, and I'm very interested in that. It's a very interesting cultural experience that we're all having together, in a small way.
Even though the role itself is not a cuddly role.
No. The guy's a very bad guy, and that's a lot of fun for an actor to play.
Uh-huh.
I think we all like to play people who are, if not bad people, seriously flawed people.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I wanted to play a clip from The Aviator in which Howard Hughes, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, mm-hmm. confronts Senator Ralph Owen Brewster. That's your part in a private meeting. Let's hear that.
Are you sure you want to do this, Owen? You want to go to war with me?
It isn't me, Howard. It's the United States government. We just beat Germany and Japan. Who the hell are you?
So what's it like playing, you know, a real-life character? Did you have to do a lot of research, or did they present you with a lot of material? How do you get into that?
No, it's kind of funny. I was so flattered to be asked to be in the movie, you know, to be directed by Scorsese and to play scenes with DiCaprio, who I think is a brilliant actor. And then we started to get ready to do the movie, and because he's a real guy, they sent me pictures of what Senator Owen Brewster really looked like. I think he was the ugliest guy I've ever seen, and a lot of the flattery started to dribble out.
Right.
I didn't feel nearly as complimented by that, but nobody really knew what he looked like, and I mean, not today. People don't know what he looked like, mm-hmm. and by and large.
Mm-hmm.
So the task was to play who he was inside, and that was really fun. And he, it's not, you know, you don't have to do. I did do some research because I looked at the tapes of the made from the kinescopes of the televised hearings. These were the first hearings that of a Senate committee hearing that had ever been broadcast by television. And I think Senator Brewster actually thought he would have the advantage over Howard Hughes by bringing him up on live television, because Hughes was a troubled person. He had obsessive compulsive disorder. He was a germaphobe. He had just recently locked himself in a room for weeks and not seen anybody. He stayed away from people. So I think Brewster thought he had the real advantage. But what he didn't realize was Hughes was a real public hero. He had been an aviator who risked his life to become the fastest man on the earth in an airplane that he designed. He mm-hmm. was brilliant. He was a brilliant engineer. And when he came into that room, you can see it in the kinescopes. He came into that room and the audience was on his side. And the television audience was surely on his side just as much as the people in the room. And Brewster, who had engineered this this come down for Hughes, found that he was the one who was coming down.
Got a little.
In real life, Hughes actually forced Brewster to come around to the other side of the table and get sworn in to defend himself.
Wow.
I don't think that could happen today. I don't think there's anybody with that clout that Hughes had then.
Well, I don't know. But, you know, you said something just a second ago that I want to explore with you just a little bit. You said that DiCaprio was a great actor. And I want to hear what your definition is of a great actor. What does that mean? Is it scope? Is it ability to play the same part really well? How do you describe that?
Oh, I think there are many definitions of what makes actors great. It's a lot of different things. And different people have a different taste that comes into play. In England, they like to see their actors acting, which means that they're you see the wheels turning
yes,
over there.
Yes, yes.
I don't particularly like that. I like an authentic experience. I like to believe that the person has entered into through his or her imagination into circumstances that help us both engage in this act of imagination, where we both are. Accepting the kind of play that we're involved in, and he has that ability. He's very convincing. He also has another ability that some people will be surprised at. When he is this guy, when he walks into that hearing room, and he's very close to the age that Hughes was in the the videotapes mm-hmm. that I watched, I swear to you, it was Hughes walking into the room. He sounded like him. He looked like him. The energy of his delivery, of the way he defended himself, it was exactly what Hughes was like. And I don't consider impersonation to be one of the great hallmarks of acting. But it's one of the things that if you can do, it's an extra element, and he could do it in this movie.
Yeah, it's interesting.
But when he's going crazy, you're watching a guy going crazy, and you're seeing a guy at another level knowing he's going crazy and trying not to. Well, he's involving you on two or three levels when he does that. That's very high-level work, I think.
But I was going to say that one of the things I think, and this is just my opinion, I guess, is the ability to play, you know, the variety of types as an actor. And that's why I wanted to play another clip of tape, this time from the piece, the part you played in Crimes and Misdemeanors, where, you know, again, you're this friendly guy, or at least so everybody thought from your roles on television, and all of a sudden you take not such a friendly part. So in this character, Leslie is clearly not feeling charitable when he sees the documentary Woody Allen's character has made about him.
Okay, you can step aside. I'm taking over this film.
What are you talking about? You can't finish my film.
I can't read your contract.
You promise.
Look, the idea was to show the real me. All right, okay, I may not be perfect, but I don't promote values that help... let me get your quote exactly. That deaden the sensibilities of a great democracy. You're fired, Cliff. You're fired. You're out. Get out of here. Go.
nothing friendly there.
Well, no, but I got to play myself there. That was finally after all these years.
I see.
But you know what interests me is three dimensions in a character. I want to see what's behind the facade. Mm-hmm. And if I can show that, if I can show how the villain is also charming and likes dogs and children, and the saint is also cranky, that's interesting to me.
Absolutely. We're taking a short break. When we come back, we continue talking with actor Alan Alda, and we're taking your calls, 800-989-TALK. You can send us an email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're talking with Alan Alda about his career and his new image as not-so-nice guy. What's your favorite Alda role? Give us a call, 800-989-TALK. Our email is totn@npr.org. And let's take one of your calls now. How about Camille in Charleston, South Carolina? Camille, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi. Thank you. Both of my comment and my question deal with Nash. Sorry. First, I wanted to say that my real-life dad was a rather horrible individual and angry and alcoholic, but when he would come home at night, MASH reruns would be on. And you and the other writers, I guess, were kind of like my television dads, showing me something a bit better of the world.
Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you. Did you ever work it out with your father, finally?
He's a pedophile, and I don't think people should work things out with him.
That's, wow, that's a hard life you had. I hope you're okay.
I think I am. But anyway, I don't want to cry, and I just I first just wanted to thank you so much. You did great writing.
Thank you. You
and the other writers did fabulous work there, and that was part of my question as well. I'm glad the Korean War is over on television, but if it were still on today, you all dealt a lot with moral ambiguities and social issues within that time frame. What do you think you all would be writing about now?
I don't know. I probably many of the same things. Oddly enough, we haven't, and probably not for a long time, we haven't solved the problems that we talked about, racism and problems of people putting money and status ahead of their human relations. I mean, all of the things that we talked about that were human problems then are still human problems, unfortunately. So we'd probably be writing about some of the same things. And, you know, we weren't writing about Korea when it was happening. We were writing about Korea 25 or 30 years later. And some of the writers were literally using it as a way to write about the Vietnam experience. I always looked at it as a way to deal with more timeless issues. You know, what good is war, and what effect does it have on people? Because that's something that we have to face every few years, apparently. And probably we'd still be dealing with those same questions.
Camille, thanks for the call.
Let's go to Camille.
Kathleen in, is it Ellensburg, Washington? Did I get that right?
Yes.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I want to congratulate Mr. Alda. My absolute all-time favorite movie is Same Time Next Year.
Huh. Well, that's nice. Thank you.
There was every possible emotion for an actor in that one film. Embarrassment, passion, silliness, the cheating husband, and as someone who's had three children, one of my very favorite moments in that film is when the two lovers are sitting on the couch. The very pregnant woman has her feet in his lap, and he becomes very embarrassed and says, "I just got turned on by someone who's 9 months pregnant." It was just... It's a classic moment.
Now, remember, this is a family show, everyone.
Yes, right, right. Now, you know what amazes me about Same Time Next Year is the number of people who come up to me in airports and say to me, "I love that movie. That's the story of my life." Ooh. Now, why would you tell that to a stranger? This is a movie about two people who for 25 years cheat on their spouses.
Yeah.
Isn't that a strange thing to tell somebody you don't know?
It certainly is. But the pieces in between each scene where it shows what was going on politically and
factually. Yeah, that was very interesting, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And my question would be, in that film, you age about 30 years until you become, I guess almost the age that you are now. Do you see yourself now as you were as an old man in that film?
Actually, I don't even think I aged as much as I am now. I think I'm older now than I was at the end of that, after a lot of makeup and making my hairline recede. You know who I thought I looked like a lot when they finished making me up in that movie toward the end? Was my father. And when I see some of the photographs, I looked a lot like him, I thought.
Interesting.
Well, I want to thank you for that film. My 81-year-old mother and I love it.
Huh.
So,
well, that's very nice.
So
thank
that
you.
That is sweet.
Thank you.
I have one little addendum to put onto that story, and that is when I called the Bucks County Playhouse to find out when it was that this play that you were in back in the darks in the 60s was, they told me, "Oh, well, you should tell Mr. Alda that Loretta Swit is coming out here for 6 weeks to play here, and the play she's doing is Same Time Next Year."
Oh, great. Yeah, she's played that a lot. I think she played it on Broadway, too. I bet she's wonderful in it. I haven't ever seen her in that play.
Loretta Swit, for people who don't know, was one of your co-stars in the MASH series.
She played Margaret Houlihan on MASH. And yeah. And there was one day I was on vacation in a dining room where I knew most of the people in the dining room. And I never read the crossword puzzle. And it said 12 across... MASH star, four letters. I said, has anybody seen 12 Across today? And the next day, I read the solution to the puzzle, and it said SWIT.
Yeah, there you go. Well, yeah. Okay, so here we have an email question from Leia in Anchorage, Alaska, who writes...
Oh, they're having trouble with their email? I can fix that.
All right. Well, no, this is a slightly different issue. Mr. Alda, what has been your least favorite screen role and why? Thanks.
That's pretty good.
Okay.
I've made some really terrible movies. I can't
well,
even.
Haven't we all?
I don't even know if I can say what the least favorite one was. I mean, there was one that was so bad it was only released in. Not only on airplanes, but just like one airplane that flew over Pittsburgh, and people were parachuting to get out of the plane to get away from it.
You have pictures of that.
It was awful. And that was called The Extraordinary Seaman. Can you imagine that? SEAMAN, I might add.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty awful. But it was made in the jungles of Mexico. And people were being carried out with typhoid, and I had to jump into the ocean on the day when there were sharks. I really didn't enjoy it all that much.
Do movies ever get made in a place where the crew or the producer just says, let's go to Tahiti, because that's really, I think we ought to make a movie there. And so everybody goes out there and they have a nice time and they make the movie. Or is it always strictly business?
I did that once. I did, when I made Sweet Liberty, which I wrote and directed.
Yes.
It took place in North Carolina. But I said, you know, we can make Southampton on Long Island look like North Carolina. And all of a sudden, people like Michael Caine said, oh, I'd like to make that movie in the Hamptons. So I had a really great cast. Everybody had a wonderful time, and we made it look like North Carolina. Then when I made a movie that took place in the Hamptons, we only had enough money to make it in North Carolina. So everything was reversed. But that was very pretty in North Carolina where we were, so that wasn't so bad.
Well selected. Well, we have another email here, and this time it's from someone else whose email seems to be working fine, Michael in New Haven, who writes, I've been continually impressed with Alan Alda's work on Scientific American Frontiers. His delightful curiosity comes through clearly, and he always asks wonderfully insightful and challenging questions of scientists on the show. The show he did on aviation pioneer Paul McCready was brilliant. And actually, we have a clip here of a PBS show, Scientific American Frontiers. And this is just, I don't know, the coincidences today are piling up. So in this episode, you visit with Nancy Hopkins. And before we hear the clip, I have to tell you that Nancy Hopkins was on Talk of the Nation Science Friday last Friday, which I hosted, and we were talking with her then. So,
oh,
you know,
great.
You're getting into my gig, which I promised I will never act again. But anyway, let's listen to this clip about talking with Nancy Hopkins, who's looking at the genetic similarities between baby zebrafish and baby humans.
How close are their genes to ours? I mean, how much can we learn about the development of a baby human from the development of a baby fish of this kind?
A lot.
Yeah?
Yes. We would be totally crushed if it weren't, can turn out that the genes were almost identical.
It's really hard to understand, because if I made a list on a piece of paper of the features that were identical between those fish right there and me, we have eyes, our tails are very different, our gills are different,
but they had a head end and a tail end, they had a heart that beats, they have a liver, they have a gut, and at the cellular level their cells have to do all the same things that your cells do.
So how did you get into this gig? I mean, it doesn't seem, you know, where does this interest in science spring? And by the way, you do it brilliantly.
Thank you. I love doing it. I'm so proud of Scientific American Frontiers. We've been doing it for 11 years now. And I love it every time I go out and spend a day with a scientist like
Nancy Hopkins.
It's just wonderful. And you can hear, I think you hear why it's so much fun to do, because the fact that it's a conversation between us, it's not a real interview. The conversational element is what makes it good for both of us, because I'm trying to find out what she's doing and what it really means and how she really does it. And I'm trying to really understand that and understand what the implications are of that with regard to the rest of science and all of nature. And she's trying to make me understand. She's not just giving a lecture. So it's a very personal interaction. And as a result, you hear the scientist's sense of humor. You hear a lighter tone come out of them than you would hear if they were lecturing or doing a straight interview. And what happens is when they get me to really understand it, that's a real little event, and the audience, I think, has a better chance of understanding sometimes very complex science. I mean, we do this having to do with astronomy and
it's tough stuff.
Particle physics. Yeah. You know, that's very tough in a couple of minutes to deal with monopoles or things like that. So, by making it personal like this, I think we're able to communicate things about science that you can't otherwise. And I think we just arrived at that just because I was curious about science, and I said I'd love it. They asked me if I wanted to host the show, and I said, but I don't want to just read a narration. I'd really like to talk to the scientists, and they didn't know what that would be like, and neither did I really, and we all just took a chance, and we've evolved a way of presenting science that's different from most television documentaries.
We're talking with Alan Alda, who has recently been nominated for an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor in the film The Aviator. We're taking your calls, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or you can send us an email. It's totn@npr.org. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Just before we leave this topic, I mean, is there any element of acting when you're having these? I mean, do the skills overlap at all? Or are you just the curious person who goes in and tries to talk to people?
No, I think there's one skill that I really make use of in a big way, and that is listening. I don't think acting can take place without listening, and I know that these conversations I have with scientists could not possibly take place because I don't go in with a set of questions. Most of the time I don't even read up on their papers in scientific journals, which I used to do in the beginning, and I found I wasn't asking good enough questions because I assumed I knew something.
Right, the too smart syndrome, yeah.
That's not so good because I would box them into a corner with a badly formed question, and they didn't know how to get out of it. Now, I let them take me through it step by step, and I listen, and I say, well, if that's true, then how could this be true? Or I don't get it, or tell me more about that. And it's really only moment by moment that I go through the conversation. And that's exactly what an actor has to do.
Yeah.
If you don't listen deeply, the connection won't take place.
Yeah.
And you know what I think I learned about listening? And I think this is true for philanthropists who are trying to help people. They have to listen to the people they want to help. It's true for people who govern other people. They have to listen to their constituency. I think listening doesn't take place unless you're willing to be changed by the person you're listening to, where you're not just waiting for a pause so you can say your thing, but you're actually letting them have an effect on you if they can.
Right.
What is it? Where in you is my salvation? Even if I think you sound like a nut, where is what you're saying going to change me and give me something I don't have already? If I'm listening like that, then I'll come up with something I didn't expect.
Yeah. There's a story, I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, that's attributed to Louis Mayer describing the difference between a good actor and a bad actor. And a good actor, if the one person walks on stage and says, hey, how are you doing? And the good actor will say, oh, I'm fine, how are you? And a bad actor, this guy walks on stage and says, how are you doing? And the bad actor says, it's on the table. So that joke works a lot with actors, actually, but it's called not listening. Anyway, let's take another call, this time from Richard in Tallahassee, Florida. Richard, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Welcome to the program. What's your question?
Well, Joe, it's good to hear you on this program. And Mr. Alda, congratulations.
Thank you.
I have just got to tell you that you've given me so much pleasure in a movie that is available only on VHS, I think. It's called The Four Seasons.
Oh, thanks,
Sam. Fantastic, written, directed by you, starring you and Carol Burnett and Sandy Dennis, Rita Moreno, Jack Watson, Bess Armstrong. What a cast! And I don't understand why I cannot find that on a DVD. My
I don't know. You know, maybe I bet they if you had a TiVo machine or somebody who knows somebody who has one, you could probably TiVo it because it's played once in a while. I love that movie. That was the first one that I both wrote and directed.
Yeah.
I had written a movie before it, but somebody else directed it, and I love it.
Yeah, it was one of the first films I saw when I moved to Santa Monica at the old Wilshire Theater, and I'll never forget it. And we've seen the tape many times, but I just feel that whoever owns the rights to that ought to get it out on DVD.
That's very nice. Thank you.
Richard, thanks very much for that call. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll finish our discussion with Alan Alda, plus an investigation of the UN Oil for Food program gets released, and Black History in the American West. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. For now, we're talking to Oscar nominee Alan Alda about his long career in television and film. And you're heading back in, well, I shouldn't say heading back. You've been and become a fixture in a new popular television program called West Wing. And I'd like to play a little clip of this. You're also a senator. I guess, you know, you're sort of leaning toward the Washington electoral rolls, I guess, these days. But in this clip, your character, Senator Vinnick, is driving through Iowa with his handlers discussing the issue of ethanol.
I never thought we should commit resources here in the first place.
We can't just bum our noses at Iowa. Let Allard clean up and take momentum into New Hampshire.
This is all about rural voters. A Republican can't win the White House without the Farm Bill.
Oh, man, overall, spending all day talking with Whistler's mom about soybean prices?
You know that's not what we're talking about.
Farmers in America don't want to get paid in the mailbox. They want to get paid in the marketplace.
Got you pretty sure I wrote it.
People know where I stand. They may not like it, but they know I'll stick with it.
This is issue 1, 2, and 3 here.
I'm not a panderer.
It's unavoidable. It's the non-panderer's pander. General Patton would have pandered on ethanol.
Et tu, Brute?
I like to throw in a little Shakespeare there at the That's nice. Hard to work that into some of the TV shows. But what's the story? Are you like the next president of the United States? What's happening? Are you allowed to say?
No, no one knows.
Oh.
I think
my wife told me to ask. That's why I had
I know,
to ask.
I know what they say. Just as they're signing their letters to raise money, to raise funds, they say, "I have no plans at this time to run."
Yeah. But is this what you know? How did this come about? Does this suit you? Do you like television, or would you rather stick in movies? Or
you know what? You know, this is very interesting. When I was a very young actor in my 20s, and I could barely find work of any kind, I thought that what I would like for the rest of my life was if I could make a living doing material that I thought was really good material with other actors who I respected in front of an audience that got it. I would be very happy. And my life has worked out that way, except for the making a living part. I've made more than a living, and yeah. I can't believe how lucky I am. And the size of the audience has been much larger than I expected, although that didn't matter to me, and it still doesn't matter. I have a great time doing a play I love in front of 400 people, just as much fun as I have doing it in front of millions, you know, in a movie or television. So it doesn't matter whether it's television or movie. I don't think it matters to any actor. What matters is if you're doing something that you connect with and where something really interesting happens, something exciting, and where all of you are in it together, and you're all a little flushed from the experience. That's wonderful.
We have time for just one more call, and let's go to Adam in Salt Lake City, Utah. Adam, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is more of an experience. When I was younger, my aunt sent me for a birthday or Christmas a record, and it was a collaboration with Marlo Thomas and many other people, including Mr. Alda there. And I remember listening to that record over and over again. And I forgot about it in my 20s. And then in my 30s, I remember it. And the other day, I went to Barnes & Noble and found it on CD. And as I listened to it again, I remember that is the record my mother played for me. It teach me that, well, it was okay to cry. Mm-hmm. Or anything else for that matter. And
Dude, you're not breaking down now, are you?
No.
Good, because
we're doing well.
Breaking up, not breaking down, I think is what's happening.
Oh, I'm sorry. But it was just a great record, and it kind of led me to, it's kind of comfort food, being able to hear that record and then watch and look at your other work.
Well, thank you. That was really Marlo Thomas's real great contribution, and you know she organized that and organized the writing of it, and I was on it with her and I directed some of the things, but she really is the one, and it's so interesting how many generations of kids have loved that record, and it's been something that they look back on fondly. And so I'm very happy for Marlo that she could make that contribution.
We have just a little clip of that here we can listen to from a song called William's Doll.
When my friend William was 5 years old, he wanted a doll to hug and hold.
A doll,
said William,
is what I need to wash and clean and dress and feed. A doll to give a bottle to and put to bed when day is through. And any time my doll gets ill, I'll take good care of it,
said my friend Bill.
There you go. Very sweet.
Well, that was nice to hear again. I like that.
Very nice. Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this segment. Alan Alda, it's been a pleasure. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you. I did, too. Thank you very much,
Thanks for coming, and I hope we can talk again sometime.
Me, too.
Alan Alda is, he's this famous actor guy, and he's also been nominated for an actor, Best Supporting Actor, in the film The Aviator.